Okay, so we have some questions. Okay, it begins, thank you for your talk. Can you flesh out dispassionate about what? Also trying to understand, encourage dispassion with the other quality, arousing energy. These are... I think one of the things of... as I was saying with the, just reflecting on dispassion, sense of a coolness, of settledness. If it's directed towards something, then generally one would be considering, say, dispassion toward objects of that would normally be objects of desire, or normally be objects of attachment, so that it could be dispassion toward the world of the senses, dispassion toward kind of the world of socializing, social interaction, could be dispassionate about the body, in the sense of recognizing the inherent burden of having a physical body, dispassionate about one's own moods and mind that keep cranking out proliferations, and so that just having a dispassion, a cooling toward different. I mean, can be have a different objects, but I think in general that sense of paying attention to dispassion is a sense of cooling and settling and clarifying, having inner clarity that one is content with, rather than constantly seeking something to gratify or stimulate. So that's just off the top of my head. In the sense of encouraging dispassion as opposed to arousing energy, they're not... how do you say, opposed to each other or antithetical? It's more actually with a quality of dispassion, in the sense that one is not expending huge amounts of energy, mental energy, either trying to get what one wants, trying to manipulate conditions, when there's a coolness toward the world around one, then that actually frees up a lot of energy for directing attention to what's useful, what's beneficial, what brings brightness, what brings calm and clarity to the mind. We tend to we tend to disperse our energy in so many different directions, and to be able to allow dispassion to create a settling, then that arousing of energy for what's wholesome and skillful. There's more there for it. Is it possible for an arhant to have seemingly negative thoughts or speech while free from defilement? In the Udana, Venerable Pilindavaja gets complained about for calling monks outcasts or lowlings. There are examples, and that's a good one, where, and it's explained that it's a It's like habits of speech that have been being carried over for many lifetimes, and it still can manifest in ways that can be unskillful. I think in terms of even in modern times, of an example that I know of is Ajahn Mahabua, considered by most people to be an arahant and free from defilement, but sometimes his speech could be pretty sharp, one ends up just sort of taking on faith, really. Okay, what does that mean? What's it mean to be an arahant, in the sense of being free from defilement? Does that mean one never does anything that can be criticized? I don't think so. I mean, even the Buddha himself said that. He himself was criticized for sometimes being too direct or saying things that are unwished for, so that by being direct or truthful, and without the people can be considered seemingly negative. Conundrums that have been going on for 2,500 years of what is it? What does it mean to be an enlightened being? What does it mean to be free from defilement? What does it look like? And on a certain level, if somebody is considered to be an arahant and they say things or do things which are considered inappropriate, then it's only one really can't know that person's mental state. One can't really know it. One only can take on faith, so that that what other people say, is that a really good standard? Probably not. In the sense that we don't really know. What we can know for ourselves is what we ourselves feel, or what we ourselves experience, what we can take responsibility for is for ourselves. So that sometimes the like Ajahn Chah would be asked sometimes to make decisions about other monks, or whether they have some attainment or not an attainment. Sometimes they're, or when they do something wrong, and then there's or considered wrong, and I remember one time in particular, a couple times where he sort of pushed to make some kind of decision and come down on it, and he would just step back and sort of said in Pali, it's sutti asutti pachatam, and sort of purity or impurity, you have to know for yourself. So it's sort of, you know, like, how do I know? So I think that's sometimes when one sees somebody who is and supposed to have some sort of attainment, and you know, the Buddha is pretty rigorous in his expectations of, particularly for monastics. There are standards of conduct and speech which are part of the discipline, part of the training, part of the precepts. And even if one were an arahant, one still has to be accountable to those precepts, and one still has to, and one can be criticized, and one can be required to, say, confess an offense or to make amends in some way. So that whether one's an arahant or not, that the conduct is what is the standard. And even in the the duties of a teacher to a student, a student to a teacher, there's a kind of an admonition to be accountable, so that if the teacher is misbehaving, it's the duty of the student to actually say something. The student's misbehaving, it's the duty for the teacher to say something. So that in the discipline and training that the Buddha set up, he didn't make exceptions for, if you're an arahant, it's okay to do whatever you want. That isn't how it works. So even in this Udana section, I think Palindavacha is criticized by the Buddha for his unskillful speech. And I think it isn't until the commentaries that they come up with the explanation. So sometimes the commentaries are I'm not totally convinced that they're all absolutely correct. Okay, can you talk about how to work with infidelity? How to not take it personally? I recently found out my husband of 30 years has had sex with others over the years that I did not know of. These are how they, one of the functions of the precepts is to lay that foundation of trust, and when that trust is breached, then it's hard to not take it personally, but it's also looking at it in terms of actions and the results of action, that actions that betray trust inevitably distance oneself from people, even if they are people we love and care for, but still that quality, when that trust is breached, it's very difficult to be impartial or to be equanimous. The And so that it's, I think one of the things is also to recognize the, say the natural feelings of anger, and dismay, or probably a whole spectrum of feelings, and to be able to recognize that, I mean, those, because sometimes we take those feelings, you know, very personally, and then it's easy to get sunk in them, to get swept up with them, to get overwhelmed, and then we end up engaging in speech and action that isn't useful or beneficial, or doesn't allow us to establish a basis of clarity. So that sometimes when recognizing the strength of feelings that are arising, it's helpful this is natural. This is a result of actions, not of my own, but of others. And now's the time to try to find a place of balance, and that can be done in many ways, either working with it oneself or consulting with others, finding some kind of professional help, engaging in a some kind of, and one has to recognize, okay, how able is it possible to begin some kind of meaningful dialogue with a spouse when there's issues of trust that are so deep. So it's not simple, and we need to. And the reality is it's going to be taken very personally, but it's also to be recognizing a difference between, say, the suffering that we feel that is generated by somebody else's unskillful actions, and recognizing when somebody else does something unskillful, it's important that we don't take on that kind, that say engage in a similar kind of unskillfulness or a way that creates, it's like picking up the suffering of somebody else and adding it to our own. So that's where that the in the chant that we do on the five subjects of frequent recollection. Now the last one is on actions and the fruits of actions. So that I'm the owner of my action, heir to my action, born of my actions, created, and whatever I should do for good or for ill, of that I shall be the heir. So that the extension of that is also that what other people do, they also receive the fruits of those actions. So then to and this is a doorway into equanimity, which isn't, just a way of glossing over things and not just, you know, it's like painting it over with some pastel color to make it look pretty. It's looking at ways to be able to step back and recognize that if somebody else is engaging in unskillful action, that is their suffering. And then to whatever degree that we pick that up and react to it in ways that increase our negativity or our unwholesome mental states, then we create suffering for ourselves as well. And it's in those cases, it's important that we reflect back on our own skillfulness or our own commitments and be able to reaffirm our own roots of wholesome action that allows us to maintain a quality of equanimity. Because without that equanimity, then it's just so easy to get caught into spirals of negativity. And it isn't an excusing of somebody else's unskillful action. It's just like recognizing, that's theirs, and it's not mine. And you're really separating that out. When one can do that, then one has a way of moving forward that has a lot more clarity and the opportunity for making skillful choices. Because when we're swept up in reactions and painful feelings ourselves, then it's difficult to make skillful choices. Okay, thank you, Ajahn. Thank you for the wonderful teachings and for being here. Can you further discuss dispassion and non-attachment in the context of the middle way? For a layperson, a healthy and loving relationship with a spouse or partner involves quote-unquote bit of passion and attachment. And, you know, I think one of the things that's important to, because when you're always paying attention to, you know, where's the suffering, and then also where's our responsibility, where's our duty, so that within the context of a lay life and family life, then it is necessary to lay the foundations for healthy relationships and healthy, loving, trusting relationships. One of the in the time of the Buddha, there was a husband and wife who, when they first met the Buddha, they addressed him as their son, and people, of course, the monks started to try to correct them and are wondering what's up with these people. And the Buddha clarified after that actually that they had, in previous lives, he had been a son to this couple. And this couple had been husband and wife for a long time, and their in previous lives as well as in the current life, So that there was a period of time in as they got older, and one of them was reflecting on their delight in each other's company and asking the Buddha how they could be, after death, be reborn and maintain their relationship. And the Buddha pointed to four particular qualities that they should be cultivating in common with each other and in sync with each other. And there was the quality of so having a common basis of faith. In a sense, they had faith in similar things. They had faith in similar goals. They had a common basis of virtue. Their values in terms of virtue and conduct and wholesomeness were common, were similar. Their basis of chaka in terms of generosity and giving an open-handedness, that they cultivated a similar basis of generosity, and then a similar and common foundation of wisdom and discernment, so that those wholesome qualities, when developed in common and in sync with each other, were the basis for that commonality and attunement, so that would be the basis for their maintaining their in this lifetime. Maintaining a relationship which was close, and they bound to each other, and in a previous life that would be the basis for that. So that's the Buddha's advice for the. A couple who are living in the world, and at the same time, you know, he would be teaching dispassion and detachment, because in order to maintain, say, qualities of clear faith and virtue and generosity and wisdom, one needs to step back from the things that cloud one's mind, cloud one's judgment, so that having a dispassion and detachment to that which is going to create dissonance within the mind, within the heart, and so that it doesn't necessarily have to be so absolute and total dispassion towards everything, detachment from every single human contact. It's recognizing what is it that creates suffering, what is it that creates complications and difficulties, and learning how to cultivate a dispassion and detachment from those things. And as one's living in the world, living within human relations, these are, you know, in many different levels, we create a sense of warmth and a delight in each other's company as human beings. I mean, it's not that's something there's not many human beings that just sort of live by themselves, completely isolated. It just isn't how human beings are hardwired. I mean, we live in relationship with each other. So that as we build those relationships, we have to learn the skills foster that and take undermine the ways that we create problems and suffering. And a dispassion and detachment from the things that create problems is your fundamental perspective for investigation. And as we live in different ways and people make different choices of what kind of say lifestyle, if I think in terms of myself as a monastic, I'll make very different choices from somebody who is living in the world and living a family life. But each person does need to pay attention to the qualities of, you know, dispassion, detachment, if we're interested in relinquishing our habits of suffering. I notice that when my mind is drifting, I don't feel physical pain. But when present, pain is to the fore. Any suggestions? Kind of the damned if you do and damned if you don't sort of thing. Sometimes it's interesting to watch that when we do kind of drift and the mind gets kind of blurry and fuzzy. And some of it is just not wanting to have to feel and experience the discomfort of existence. And it's not a wonderful solution for the cessation of suffering, but it's what we do. So that to recognize that tendency, and then because when as we develop the habits of tuning out and drifting off, then you know, those are habits of a lack of clarity. So that bringing awareness, bringing attention, and then the reflections on the different ways that pain and discomfort affect us, and then building a repertoire of skills that, and particularly just patience and the ability to not be reactive or fearful of something painful or uncomfortable, because that's generally what. Because there's a physical pain or physical discomfort, and then there's the feeling in the mind of this is completely intolerable. I can't bear it. How do I get out of it? And to be able to turning attention to the quality of patience. And patience isn't just dumbly accepting something or just sinking into something dumbly, but the patience is the ability to recognize what we're experiencing, but not getting swept up in reactions. And there's the verses in the it's one of the very early teachings of the Buddha. It's called the Ovada Patimokkha, and it's a summary of the of the teachings, and two monks who were attained. And the very first line is, you know, patience is the supreme austerity, supreme tool for burning up defilements. And so the Buddha putting that right out there very quickly, that quality of a patience. And of course, that what that quality of patience does is give us the stability to let pain or discomfort arise, and when we don't react to it out of fear or aversion, then we can either oftentimes just relaxing into it, and with awareness, it tends to dissipate it, as opposed to when we have, we're struggling against it, or pushing it away, it just tends to stir it up even more and make for more more discomfort, more pain, more tension in the body and in the mind. And that Erik Ajahn Chah, I don't know how many times I heard of it, training under him. I just said, all I'm teaching you is patient endurance. And that, those are the tools of being patient with what we're experiencing. Because in general, when we're not moving away from things, we're not sort of focused on getting what we want or getting something that we can distract ourselves with, then, yeah, that just that general feeling of discomfort of having a body and having a mind starts to manifest really, really clearly, because that's what's there. So that being willing to be patient and steady, and when I say patient in the sense, being steady and clear with what we're experiencing, and not being intimidated by it. Then it, you can allow things to arise, and you can allow them to cease. And it's in the ceasing of sensation, the ceasing of the moods, that we realize, oh, there's our freedom right there. This is, it's not something interminable. It's not something permanent. It arises, it passes away. This is a question. What do you think about the bed that the center provides for us? I believe it's against the eight precepts. So, I mean, if somebody's concerned about it, the floor is actually quite comfortable. I've been sort of back and forth between the two of them. So they're, one is it's up to for most people, the goal of, or the purpose of the precepts is to provide a basis of simplicity, and by most people's standards, especially in America, it's not, this is not all that luxurious, so finding ways of creating simplicity, because the purpose of the precepts is to, especially in terms of the, like with the eight precepts, there's two functions for the precepts. One is the function of virtue, and the other is the the function of renunciation. So that the, say, five precepts are foundations of virtue. Eight precepts are tools for renunciation, but and it's mixed with the with the aspects of virtue, so that the say the switching out of the third precept and maintaining a period of celibacy is a precept for training in renunciation. The precepts on not eating after noon, stepping back from entertainment, and then the refraining from the use of higher luxurious, actually beds and sitting places as well. Those are renunciant precepts, so that they're opportunities for developing simplicity when we and those are voluntary. We take them on, and to whatever degree we want to be cultivating simplicity and a opportunity for 'cause what say the aspects of renunciation is what they do is give us an opportunity to look at our habits, look at our tendencies in a different light, and they so that by creating a container, I mean there's the with the elements of the precepts that are grounded in virtue of not taking the life of any living creatures, not taking what isn't given, not speaking falsely or harshly, then we create a foundation of virtue and trust. And when we take on the standards, they're all, I mean, they work together and create an atmosphere of practice and training, so that if one wants to take something on in a way that is say over and above the actual precepts, it's one can experiment. But in general, it's fairly basic standards. Okay, so I think those are all the questions. We could take a short break and then come back to for evening puja in about 5 minutes or so.